This is an ABC podcast.
Resorts, homes and the newly built hospital have been washed away.
I'm just holding on for dear life here. This isn't fun.
Pacific prepared.
Pacific prepared.
Plan this time before disaster strike.
Every natural disaster gets worse.
Save what for dream. You must ready.
Helping your community.
Helping your family.
Helping you.
Pacific prepared.
Pacific prepared.
Pacific prepared.
Mula, I'm Josiah Nanunga, based in Fiji.
Hi, I'm Fred Hooper, based in Australia, and this is Pacific Prepared.
It's a show all about natural disasters, climate change, and traditional knowledge, and how these things are all connected. And you'll hear that through stories from right across the Pacific.
Each week we work with local reporters. They're on the ground letting us all know what's happening in this space and what people want to hear about. On today's show, continuing the conversation from Solomon Islands about knowledge sharing and how this is actually connected to climate change.
Also, it's been raining in most parts of the Pacific over the past few weeks, even a month, and we'll talk more about that.
And we'll learn more about algal blooms, what they look like, where they occur, and how the climate impacts them.
That's all coming up. This is Pacific Prepared.
We need to be prepared for the future.
Helping you stay safe.
We have built a seawall 2 times, but it did no good.
What happens when something goes wrong and how do they respond to it?
Plan this time before disaster strike.
Every natural disaster gets worse.
Pacific prepared.
Pacific prepared.
Pacific prepared.
Last week, we heard about the importance of traditional knowledge and how this can be inculcated or useful in terms of dealing with the impacts of climate change or even predicting natural disaster. And it was really interesting, Fred, when we heard a story from this group or non-government organization, how they are capitalizing or how they are tapping into traditional knowledge or aspects, you know, to deal with these environmental issues. Eh? And that was part of the discussion last week.
Yeah. It was Millicent Barty from Solomon Islands, and the organization is called Custom Keepers. And that story was from Jeremy Guao. And yeah, she was talking about sort of making these, her main point was probably about making the kind of traditional Solomon Islands huts.
Right.
So that they could then go and teach traditional knowledge. This is the space that they would do it in, you know, from their ancestors, basically. So that was one of the main points that Millicent was trying to make, that they would try to rebuild some of these huts so that they can then, then reteach traditional knowledge in 2024, in a 2024 setting, I suppose.
It's not only helping this group or the people in the society, you know, how to deal with climate change. It's also a way of maintaining the tradition and custom or culture within this group of people or in that society. So it's like a win-win situation altogether.
Yeah, exactly. It's, there's so much to it that, and this is just a small part of it that, you know, that Millicent talks about. But yeah, it's super interesting though. So we're going to hear a little bit more from Millicent this week on Pacific Prepared as well. And she speaks more this week about what it was like working with those sort of knowledge holders and those traditional knowledge holders.
Also, should be interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And also how traditional knowledge is also linked back to climate change and how those two sort of interact.
Okay, hello, ¿qué tal? Thank you to my Pacific Prepared for having me. Name blow me Millicent Barty and me blow Solomon Islands, and I am the founder of Custom Keepers.
Working with knowledge holders, how do you find it? Like working with knowledge holders, you know, get to understand, you know, when it comes to reviving knowledge. Yeah, how do you find it?
I think we've been incredibly lucky that still in Langalanga, the elders that we have left are all knowledge holders. But we're also noticing that there are a handful of young people who are also custom keepers. They're knowledge holders. And this comes to understanding, too, that some parts of traditional knowledge is often what we call a ilu, yeah? So it's your gift, it's your power. So to be able to go through this journey and identify who are the young knowledge holders and sort of identify the elders that we do have left, I think we've been incredibly lucky in that sense, because they're still there, and it is they who have welcomed us and have connected with us and pushed us towards this desire of theirs. So I'm going to say, you know, cultural preservation is not a new desire. It's not a new thing. It's been on the hearts and minds of our people for a very long time. But there's just not been, I guess, a proactive activity to sort of help cultivate and bring it, you know, revive the practices of custom storytelling, yeah? So it's also through our knowledge holders, we call them our Chiefs Coalition. It's through them that the idea of the Fifi emerged through one of our co-creation workshops last year. So in my head before, it was like, you know, we've got two great programs. Let's just go to the village and then get an elder and a young person and put them all together and they can start exchanging. But it doesn't work like that. And that's one of the biggest lessons I've learned, that custom knowledge has its own space where we can uplift and hold the sacredness and the importance and its essence, yeah? And you know, these practices, to uphold and respect them, they need their own space, which for us in Langa Langa, it will be the Fifi.
When you talk about the traditional knowledge, when it comes to custom keepers, how do you see traditional knowledge in the long term going forward?
I think for building climate resilience within our communities, it is absolutely necessary that we repatriate traditional knowledge. And this is for now, this is for tomorrow, this is for the future. And I mean, the climate crisis in itself is a global issue, and us repatriating our traditional knowledge should not be seen as, you know, we're going to be okay adapting to climate change. No, it doesn't work like that. It's really recognizing that we have no control over losing our islands. We have no control over king tides. We have no control over the frequency of cyclones. But we do, but where we can sort of have some control is through understanding the natural patterns of things, through reconnecting with our respect and the relationship we once had with our place, our environment, respecting the ocean, respecting the land. And it's through that process then we can sort of control and plan a bit better, which increases our resilience when it comes to climate change. Yeah. But again, yes, in saying that, this is us trying to find meaningful ways that are indigenous to who we are, to survive what's happening to our islands. But it's not to dilute or desensitize the fact that we are losing our homes. We are losing who we are as people, our culture, our traditional ways of living. If we lose our islands, because our customs are so deeply embedded in our physical land, if we lose that, we lose who we are. And it's crazy to think that, you know, in this day and age, it's crazy to think that civilizations or cultures, people can be extinct, but this is something that our people live every day. It's just a struggle to survive what's happening to our islands. The future is very uncertain, but we can't just sit around and watch. We do have the knowledge, we do have the traditional practices that have sustained our ancestors to survive, you know, the changes that Earth's seen over time. And I believe that, you know, the time is now. We need to just start working on repatriating a lot of that to help us. Plans going forward is always funding dependent. Custom Keepers, like the vision we have and the programs and activities that we're working on, they are huge undertakings. And that's a reality where even I know that it needs collaboration. We need more people jumping on board and supporting in whatever way that they can, because we can't do this alone. And cultural preservation has always just been expressed. Every conference, seminar that I've attended over the decade, you'll always hear someone saying, we need to preserve our culture. We need to do this, da 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 da. So to me, Custom Keepers is, well, let's actually try and do something about it. The model, we're just trying to figure out what model will work to support our community needs as well. But moving forward, we're excited about completing the construction of the Fi-Fi by September and then piloting our two programs. And once we refine our community model and also build our digital repository where we can preserve our custom stories on, once we finally have that, we look forward to scaling it to communities who would like to be part of the custom keeping journey and are serious about revitalizing their traditional knowledge and cultural heritage.
And those were some great insights from Milson Batty. Thank you so much for your time. And thanks to our Pacific Prepared reporter, Jeremy Guo, for that story from the Solomon Islands.
I'm just holding on for dear life here.
For women, it's always safety first. They are the first responder.
You're listening to Pacific Prepared.
Joe, I don't know if you've seen or heard about algal blooms at all. Is that something that you know anything about or much about at all?
Well, Fred, to be frank and to be honest, this is the first time for me to actually hear and read about these two terms, right? These two words.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I first saw it, I had to go online and then probably see a look at the picture, the photo, and try to familiarize. Oh yeah, just to see if I've seen it somewhere in Fiji or any Pacific Island country that I've visited over the past few months. But this is the first time and should be interesting.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I think if a lot of people who live in the Pacific might have seen it, might not know what it's called, they might not associate the name with it. So, you know, if you do live near the water, you might have noticed something sort of slightly different. And there has been some large algal blooms spotted over the summer period. So I just sent you a photo. I don't know if you can check it while we're talking or not. So this is an algal bloom that I just sent you that was spotted in Tonga over the summer, like probably a month ago, maybe 6 weeks ago now. And you can see the – so it's like a shot from – sort of looks like a drone.
It's like an aerial shot,
or something. Yeah, it's an aerial shot, yeah.
Yeah.
And you can, it's like the mouth of a river leading out to the ocean, basically.
Mm.
And you can see those kind of like sandy colored streaks in the water. That's actually what the algal bloom is. Ah. It's kind of algae that has sort of grown and produced and multiplied by itself. And that's, it becomes these massive sort of clouds of algae in the water, basically.
Right. So, would you have any idea where all these algal blooms, you know, the source, where it's coming from?
Yeah, well, I'm not an expert, but this is my very basic understanding, Joe, that there is always algae in the water, but at times, so when the conditions are right, whether the temperature, you know, the tide probably, all sorts of conditions with the water are just right, the algae can sort of reproduce at a really fast and rapid rate. And that's why it becomes massive and it really obvious to people to see. And it looks like sometimes it can look completely red, like the ocean will look red, or it will look really like that color there. It's kind of like a sandy color that we can see.
So you mean to say they usually appear during high temperatures or during summer?
I think it depends because there's different types of algae, and this is what, you know, I'm like I said, I'm not an expert, but we did speak to someone who knows about this. But yeah, you're right. There is all these different factors that come into play when it comes to algal blooms. There's heaps of different things. And so, yeah, we spoke to somebody who knows this exact topic. This is her, like, her thing, her speciality. She's from one of the universities in New Zealand, and she is specializing in this stuff. So we spoke to her about this exact topic.
My name's Dr. Kirsty Smith, and I'm a research scientist at the Cawthron Institute in Nelson, which is a private independent research institute in a small city called Nelson at the top of the South Island. And we have a big group of researchers here focusing on harmful algal blooms, both marine and freshwater species, including a lot of chemists working on characterising the toxins and biologists working on characterising the ecology of all of these different species.
You know, when we're talking about algal blooms, what are they, more or less?
Algal blooms are generally when you're referring to microalgal blooms, which are microscopic algae that live in all aquatic environments. So they're a natural part of the ecosystem and like a really important part of the ecosystem because they're a food or nutrition source basically for the entire food web. But sometimes under certain conditions, some of these species can like proliferate to really high numbers. And that's when you can get a bit of imbalance and impacts on the ecosystem. So some of these species, for example, can produce toxins that can accumulate in seafood, for example, which then can cause illness in humans when they consume them. Other things is just the huge amount of biomass that they produce can cause reductions in oxygen in the seawater, so that has impacts on the animals that live in those ecosystems. And then they can also just cause nuisance problems by just being causing water discolorations, or when they decompose, they can get a bit smelly and produce aerosolized compounds as well that can cause harm to humans too. So
you just touched on there that they can produce toxins, or maybe they do quite often produce toxins. What's the purpose of them actually producing those toxins in the first place?
Yeah, that's one of those great mysteries that no one's managed to resolve soundly yet, but there's lots of theories around why they do produce these toxin compounds, because they are kind of energetically expensive to produce. And one of the main theories is that they act as kind of a grazing deterrent, so a little bit like how plants will produce toxins so that other animals don't want to eat them, that maybe these algae are producing toxins so that animals don't graze on them or consume them as well. Other theories are that they may be linked to signalling, so ways that they can kind of talk to each other in the environment as well. Lots of different theories on why, but they're quite complex, so maybe they are just do exist for lots of different reasons as well. There's no one single reason why.
Are there kind of environmental factors that do play into, I guess, making the perfect conditions for these algal blooms to become what they are?
Yeah, there's definitely environmental variables that we know promote algal blooms. So these are things like increases in nutrients, warmer temperatures. Also, when you get warmer temperatures, say for during the summer months, the seawater or the water column becomes much more stable. And this actually starts to promote algal blooms as well, because you get this real division in the water column, where you've got the warm kind of upper layer, and then below that you have a cooler layer that's got a lot of nutrients in it. And so some of these harmful algal bloom species have the ability to kind of benefit from both of those high nutrients and the warmer waters. So that means they're able to outcompete, you know, other species that are occurring and become an algal bloom.
How does climate change impact what happens with algal blooms?
Yeah, so there's lots of theories or predictions that climate change will increase the occurrence of harmful algal blooms by lots of different mechanisms. You know, warmer seawater temperatures generally mean that algal species grow faster and at higher concentration. There's changing distributions of species associated with that as well. So, for example, you know, species that we typically expected to mainly occur in tropical regions, for example, we're starting to see them expanding their distributions more towards the poles. Even within New Zealand, we've seen species that we'd normally associated, for example, with the northern parts of New Zealand starting to occur further south. And then there's other things about climate change, you know, not just increasing seawater temperatures, but changing currents, increased sedimentation. Some areas we're seeing, you know, increased rainfall events and these kind of massive storm events, you know, that cause a whole lot of runoff into the coastal environment, which can also increase algal growth because there's more nutrients, for example. There's a lot of theories that it will, but small pockets of data to suggest that's also true. But yeah, we still need more information in this space around what the actual impacts will be and how we can predict what will happen in the future.
Do the blooms sort of vary from region to region? Like, are there different, you know, blooms that you might find in specific countries, if that makes sense?
Yeah, definitely with the different, you know, the species that we'd see in temperate environments, is, for example, is a lot different from what we'd see in tropical environments. In the tropics, the most harmful algal species are the ones that cause Ciguatera poisoning, which generally is caused by fish consumption. So these are microalgal species that are benthic. So they don't live in that water column environment. They grow attached to things like seaweed and corals and rocks. And then they are consumed by herbivorous fish. And as such, toxins accumulate through the food web and cause human illness when they consume the fish species.
Kirsty, have you been out in the field? I mean, I'm assuming you've been out in the field and studied numerous blooms before. What's it like to see them, you know, in person?
Yeah, they can be really impressive. Just, you know, hundreds of metres of water column, you know, discoloured, and they can be quite beautiful, like you mentioned before. And a lot of them can actually bioluminescent species too, it seems, these toxic ones. So that at night time, I don't know if you've ever seen sometimes if you go out at night time into the ocean and move the water around, or the waves crash, you can see it kind of glowing. I don't know if you've ever experienced that
before. I have seen that before, and it happens in Tasmania, yeah, where I live. So, yeah, it does happen here a little,
yeah,
bit.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, it's pretty amazing. It still looks beautiful. Yeah, some of them can be not so beautiful as well. You know, they can be, not that too attractive, brown colours and kind of pretty smelly, to be honest. But yeah, it's pretty interesting phenomenon. Some of them can last for, you know, up to 6 months. We've had issues like that here in New Zealand. Yeah. Whereas other ones will kind of come and go within days. So yeah, it's pretty interesting. They can be quite dynamic.
And that was Kirsty Smith from the Cawthorn Institute, which is New Zealand's largest independent science organisation.
Disaster is part of our life, and recovering is also part of our life.
As you see, they're smiling despite the devastation. That's how we are.
You are listening to Pacific Prepare.
Joe, every time I go onto social media lately, all I see is flooding in different parts of the Pacific, but particularly, yes, it seems in Fiji, yes, as well. And you're shaking your head at the moment. It feels like it's been raining there for weeks. Is that right?
No jokes. It's been raining over the past 2 months, I would say, from the end of January to February last month, every week. Heavy rain across the country, especially in Fiji. And not only in Fiji, we've been, as you've said, as you've correctly stated about, you know, seeing posts on social media, photos and videos from other parts of the country. Even last week or last 2 weeks, we heard about a story from Tonga about the heavy rain and flooding. And they had to, you know, the ministry or the relevant authority has to impose some stringent mechanism to try and improve the drainage system. Eh?
But also, Joe, I know just from my point of view, Pacific people don't tend to complain very much. That's my take on it. And you might find that funny, but how's the feeling at the moment though? I mean, you know,
honestly, Fred, yeah. Honestly, like, you know, especially for people who lives who are residing in the central division, eh? So they've been complaining about, you know, doing laundry, they're unable to dry up the clothes on time, you know, the clothes may, you know, when they do the laundry, yeah, it might take 2 to 3 days.
Things.
Yeah. They are, I would say, fed up, tired with the amount of rain we've been getting. In how, you know, that little issue, that how rainfall, how flooding, you know, can become a complex issue altogether, not only infrastructure, how it also affects the psychological or the overall well-being of a particular person.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Hopefully some good news on the horizon for people in Fiji and people right across the Pacific too. So, yeah, if you do need to check out the forecast, head to your local Met Service website, wherever you're listening to this. So I'm crossing my fingers for you, you see? Yeah. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Fred.
Joe, we've covered floods, we've covered traditional knowledge in Solomon Islands, and we've spoken about, we've learned about algal blooms. Hopefully we've learned a bit about
them. I've learned a lot. And I trust our listeners have learned something as well over the past few weeks.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially with this new topic that I learned today.
Exactly, yeah. Thanks for your help today, Joe. I really appreciate it.
You're most welcome, Fred. Talk to you next week.
What's your plan? Are you ready to leave your home? Plan now before disaster strikes. Pacific Prepared.
This show was made on the lands of the peoples of Stony Creek Nation in Lutruwita, Tasmania. Also the people of the Vanua Uviti. Pacific Prepared is supported with funding from the Australian Government's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Any views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the Australian Government. It's produced and distributed in partnership with Radio Australia and networks across the Pacific, including Radio New Zealand Pacific, National Broadcasting Corporation of Papua New Guinea, Palau Wave Radio, Fijian Broadcasting Corporation, Samoa National Radio 2AP, Solomon Islands Broadcasting Corporation, and Tonga Broadcasting Commission. My name's Fred Hooper, and thanks to my co-host in Fiji, Josina Nunga. Please share any information you've learned today, and stay safe. This has been Pacific Prepared.